Yes, indeed, spring training has begun for all 30 major league teams, and our special guest today has plenty to say about the game of baseball that he played so very well and the game of golf that continues to drive him today. Along with Janice Self, our executive producer, I am Kelly Elbin, welcoming you back to Musings on Golf. Look, we specialize in great storytelling on our show, and what a special interview you will hear shortly with National Baseball Hall of Famer John Smoltz. John, you know today really as the lead analyst for Fox Sports coverage of Major League Baseball, dedicated to his craft as a baseball player, passionate about being a starter and a reliever in baseball. And those traits have carried over to his incredible love for the game of golf. He's really a good player. And he actually credits golf with extending his playing career as a major league pitcher. You'll hear from John in just a minute. After the interview with John Smoltz, we're going to hear from Colin Morikawa, who had a bit of a dramatic waiting game at the end of the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am to be able to win for the first time in 5 years on American soil. And you'll also hear from Tiger Woods, a really interesting press conference that Tiger had in advance of the Genesis Invitational that he hosts at Riviera Country Club, which will be the final event on the West Coast swing for the PGA Tour in 2026. Boy, did Tiger cover a lot of ground. Real quick in regards to John Smoltz. You know, Bob Bupka, my late co-host, and I have had some great interviews over the years. I don't know, frankly, if any is any finer than what you're going to hear from John Smoltz. And I think because John is such an insightful guy, and as I mentioned the word craft earlier, and I think it's true, John was not only a great starter for the Atlanta Braves and a couple of other teams for years and years, but he was then had an injury and became a terrific reliever. So he understood all of what went into being a great pitcher and the craft that one must, you know, attain to be great at that level. And the same is followed with John in golf. You'll hear a lot of his talk about wanting to win the American Century Celebrity Golf Championship. You'll hear about him playing with Tiger Woods. It's just extremely interesting comments from John. You're really going to enjoy it, and you'll hear it right after you hear from our great corporate partners, our friends, our supporters at William & Harry, Titleist, and the Friars Golf Club. Our friends at William & Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William & Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Is your golf life stuck in a bunker of country club hassles? Tired of the wait lists and the six-figure initiation fees? Well, at the Friars Golf Club, we take care of all of the hard work. Planning exclusive trips and unforgettable rounds on top-rated courses, so all you have to do is show up, have fun, and make lifelong friendships on the first tee, the 19th hole, and far beyond. Our terrific 2026 lineup includes international destinations like Dubai and Scandinavia, plus top domestic resorts such as Sand Valley and Black Desert, and access to some great private clubs. Join the Friars Golf Club today. Email us at info@thefriars.com, the word musings in the subject line, to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. We invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience with the Friars Golf Club. As a pitcher, our special guest today just about did it all, winning 213 major league games and saving 154 others, earning the Cy Young Award in 1996 and gaining induction into the National Baseball Hall of Fame on his first ballot in 2015. As a golfer, he's impressed the elite in our game, with Tiger Woods saying that he is the best player the Tiger has seen outside of the PGA Tour. He's the lead analyst for Fox Sports coverage of Major League Baseball, and we're thrilled to have him with us today. John Smoltz, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome you to Musings on Golf. How are you, John?
I'm doing pretty good. Survived the coldest stretch of really the Southeast, and hopefully looking for warmer weather and more golf to be played.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You played in the LPGA event that ultimately was curtailed to 54 holes. To say that it was cold, and I live in Palm Beach Gardens, not too far from Orlando, and it was cold here. But, John, it was pretty brutal there in Orlando, wasn't it?
It was. Packing for the trip, I was going to be there about 10 days, had to do some family stuff in Orlando, and knew that there was a chance to be pretty cold. Never dreamt it was going to be that cold. So I had four layers on. Ironically, for my golf game where it was, and I was a little bit beat up physically, I needed chaos to kind of be, to level the playing field of the pure hard-hitting young golfers that are in that field. So chaos worked to my advantage. And the elements are something that I've been used to here in Georgia when we get about 2 weeks worth of that kind of weather. But never did I think 24 degrees would be something we'd hear about in Orlando. And that definitely hit on Sunday.
John, when the weather is good and when you're playing and you know, next to the best women players in the world, I know you've played next to the best men players in the world. What's the differences? What are the similarities? What do you learn from the women, for example? What do you learn from the men at the elite level?
7 years ago, I thought, maybe even 8 years ago, I was able to win this event a couple times. And I thought my score would be relative to what their score would be based on us playing the same tees. I really thought my length would be a decided advantage. And what I came to find out, it wasn't even close. First of all, my length wasn't big advantage that I thought it was going to be. They surprised me with their length, but the consistency and the quality of their shots was unmatched. Their mechanics, I would say fairly, they don't spin the ball as much, obviously. They don't create as much RPMs, but their distance control and their ability to just not make mistakes. Obviously, they're the best in the world. And my winning score, which I was proud of, was 7 under, and their winning score, a three-way tie, of 14 under. So I would have lost a lot of different friendly wagers on the ability to, you know, match with the field. And I've just been impressed beyond what TV can show.
Is it true, John, is it more relatable to your game or to maybe to the amateur golfers? Is it more relatable to play among the women golfers as opposed to the elite men?
I would say yes, but if the right yardage is played for both sports, they can compete. Meaning you can't go 7,500, 7,600 yards, 7,800 yards, which the men play, and expect that the women are going to be able to have that kind of consistency back there. But look, when you ask the question, when it play with some of the best men in the world, when I miss the green, I know I lose. That's the difference.
Yeah,
their ability to score and not make bogeys is off the charts for the men. Their ability to pound it 350 yards, not caring if it's in the rough, is off the charts. And yeah, can you on an average day in my golf club here, I could probably score what is equivalent to some of their scores, but that's just giggle golf. Tournament golf is totally different. Speed of the greens, pin locations. That's why I tell people all the time, I've had experience in the U.S. Open, Champions Tour events. You cannot, if you're sitting at home in a handicap of a plus two or better, or even a scratch, even come close to competing at that level unless you're going to dedicate the rest of your life to getting every aspect of your game just solid.
I remember I followed Lee Trevino for many years, actually caddied for him in the Ryder Cup in 79, and have known Lee well. I remember one year at the PGA Championship, I can't remember what year it was, John, somebody shot like 63 in a practice round on Tuesday. And they asked Lee about it. He said, yeah, wait till Thursday comes along.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
It's just right. It's just a different ballgame.
It is. I was so excited one year. We had the U.S. Open qualifier here at Hawks Ridge. So I was like, oh my gosh, this is perfect. So I took a buddy of mine out the day before the qualifier and shot 63. And he was like, oh man, I didn't even realize what was going on because I was trying to tell him where to hit the ball. So I wasn't paying attention. Which is I need to learn that more often. When we get to hole number 11, he goes, do you realize you're 8 under? I'm like, no, but thanks for telling me, because now all I'm thinking about it. And I made one birdie the rest of the way in. Well, come qualifier, two things. One, I didn't know we had to walk. This is not a fun course to walk. Two, I was still had my bad hips and didn't have them replaced, so I was excited to get in the cart. And three, I didn't make anything. I was 1 under going into like the 7th hole, and obviously it takes a much bigger number than that, and I did not play well enough. So it is so – I never realized the pros on the practice rounds don't hole out most of the time. I didn't get that. Like, they don't even want to score. And all I was thinking about is score. I want positive feelings. I want – and so it made me realize, you know how many no-hitters I threw in the bullpen? A lot. And it doesn't matter until you cross the white line and play in that game. So that Thursday comment makes a lot of sense.
John, I mentioned Tiger Woods at the outset. You played a fair amount of golf with him, right?
Yeah, I did back in the day, a long time ago. We haven't played in quite some time, but we used to play quite often in spring training. And obviously in the heyday of his career, it was one of the greatest moments of my life to step on the course with the number one best player in the world. And he loved competing. He loved coming to the playoff games that we would play in baseball. He hit off me at the stadium.
Right.
We had I had the time of my life, but I like to think we definitely had a great time playing all those golf rounds. And I learned so much just seeing him practice, going to the range and watching him hit 20-yard cuts, 20-yard hooks out of divots, flopping it over the golf bag. I watched shots that I didn't think were possible. And I realized not only did he have the greatest imagination in the history of golf, but his determination and will was just that much better. And so when he would miss a shot on the golf course, and obviously he's not in that U.S. Open grind, I would tell everybody I took to play with him, don't get in a trash-talking war with Tiger. Just don't. His antennas are down. Leave them down. As soon as you say something or feel like you got to say something, his antennas go up and it's over. And no better time did that happen. I've told this story a bunch. We were at Isleworth in a fivesome, and it was on the 5th hole, and I literally won the first 4 holes miraculously. I got some shots. I got 2 aside. And so on the 5th hole, par 3, it read 5-4-3-2-1. So everybody had a different score. And my buddy had the hole-in-1, and I said, what's more believable when we get back home, the fact that you got a hole-in-1 or you beat Tiger by 4 on 1 hole? He gave me the universal sign that he was not happy there, and he went literally 12 under in the next 22 holes. We played 27 holes, and it was one of the most unbelievable displays. But that's what he would do, and that's what made him so great.
And that was from a little poke of the Tiger?
A little poke that I probably wish I wouldn't have done, and he just went nuclear on us. And it was fun to watch, even though I knew I couldn't win now. But he definitely would have this gear. You know, I remember the Stephen Ames comment in match play that he was trying to be somewhat complimentary, but also giving hope to, this is the chance we have, you know, the way Tiger's hitting it, he's more beatable today than ever before. And I think it was 10-8, that he beat Stephen Ames. And, you know, that's what made him so great.
Hey, John, let's look at 2026. If you have a goal, I know you're a goal-oriented person. If you could have one of two things, let's say you could correctly predict the score of every World Series game in 2026, or you could finally win the American Century Celebrity Golf Championship in 2026. John Smoltz, which of the two?
It's definitely Tahoe. My age and my time clock, whatever you want to say, is getting to the point where I need to figure this thing out sooner than later. My running joke, I finished second, you know, in the Hilton Grand. I've got about 7 second places. And in my baseball career, we get a lot of second places. So I'm tired of them. I want to get a first place. I've been close. I've not really enjoyed those greens, even though it's the greatest venue in the world to play at that type of level for us, our competition. So that answer is win Tahoe.
Figured as much. Joe, John Miller, our mutual friend, John started the American Century. He said to me, reached out to John last night. He said, tell Mr. Smoltz he just needs to get off to a little faster start on Friday. Is there some truth to that?
There's 100% truth. I don't know what it is about my golf rounds. I'm too conservative. I want to, you know, I always make a push and the push is a little too late. Something in my brain I've got to shut off. I'll be honest with you. I wish it wasn't this way. I count points. I need to stop counting points.
Yeah.
I need to forget the hole before, two holes before. You know, they say you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Well, I'm learning certain things about golf that need to be turned off. And starting off slow or conservative is something that I need to figure out how to do better.
Hey, John, as a, you know, at being at home and watching that event, it's so much fun and they do such a fabulous job with it. How do you balance as a serious player, a grinder? How do you balance the fun of that event with trying to win the damn thing?
Yeah, and that's a big challenge. I need to passionately, I want to play in that thing every year, right? I try to clear my schedule. I've got the All-Star game, and Fox is so generous and gives me the next weekend off or the weekend before. And it's not that I care too much. It's just, you know, being able to play golf in that place, we do step away and have a good time. My caddy is Greg Olson, former catcher. We have a great time, him and his wife, my wife. We do things away from the game, but when we step on the course, obviously I want to give my best. One thing I'm not great at, and I'm learning, is the patience that it takes to play in that event. And you do a lot of waiting, and there are things that you've got to trust when you wait 15 minutes on particular holes, that you got to have that swing. And you can't have 5 different swings. Problem is, I've had 5 different swings before, and that's not a good formula. So my quality of golf here at home in a golf cart is 36 holes in 3 hours and 10 minutes. So if that gives you any understanding of walking a golf course, I don't mind walking a golf course. Actually, it's not that. It's being able to waiting for a while to feel like you're making that first swing again.
Heard you tell Dan Patrick, he asked you about which, in your opinion, for you was harder to master, hitting a golf ball. Which is harder to master, playing the game of golf well, playing baseball well? And you said golf. I wonder if you could elaborate on that, John.
Yeah, there's no, it's not even close. Look, I picked up golf when I was about 22, 21. I was bored out of my mind in, you know, minor leagues, maybe a little bit earlier than that. I picked it up. And I never had lessons. I didn't want it to get mechanical like baseball is. Baseball and pitching was so mechanical. Golf has so many aspects of being exposed. In a team sport, you can get hidden of some of the things and your weaknesses. So baseball, I could make a terrible pitch. My defender makes a great play, and it looks like I executed well. Golf does not work that way. Just like the environment that we played in Orlando, if you don't make a good quality shot, you're going to get exposed. Imagine in golf, all right, my weak spots might be a 70-yard sand shot or a flop off of a tight lie. I can avoid it for a while if I do my part, but eventually I'm going to be put in that spot and there's no hiding from it. There's no handing the club to somebody else to hit the shot. Golf is about tension that you deal with and the ability to repeat mechanics no matter what they look like. And then the guys that do it and the people that do it the best are the ones the most successful.
Then is there also a factor that in golf, you have a lot of downtime in between shots in terms of where your mind may go at times, where it needs to be, the mental challenge of preparing for that next shot?
No doubt. I love the fact that as a pitcher, I got to determine the tempo and there was no shot clock. We pitched fast. And you're right. If I had to wait 3 minutes between each pitch, my goodness, I don't know that I would be a very good pitcher. Now, I'd like to think I would learn how to do that. But in golf, I don't go out every day to try to mimic a 5.5 hour round. I'm not going to play golf if that's the case. I tried to survive the 5.5 hour rounds in tournament play to learn. And that's why you see a lot of guys in the professionals, they just don't seem bothered by a lot. And it may look like their personality isn't much, but the reality is they've learned how to deal with that environment. And emotions in golf are, people want to see them, but they don't actually work in your favor all the time. Where emotions in football, you can ride that emotion for a 10-minute period. Baseball, maybe a little bit. Golf, not so much. You know, the adrenaline rush can actually work against you if you're not tempered, don't know how to temper it.
John Smoltz, you mentioned about picking up the game in the minor leagues, bored out of your mind, et cetera. You obviously advanced to the major leagues. Did you play a fair amount of golf with your good friends Tom Glavine and Greg Maddux? When you were with the Braves all those years, did you play in spring training down here in Florida? Did you play during the regular season?
We played all the time. We had a manager who understands how we tick. Matter of fact, spring training, a lot of position players would get mad at us because we were leaving about 2.5-3 hours before they got done. We would get 36 in, work on our win game in spring training. But one people, they don't understand. We got all our work done, did everything we had to do pre-getting on the field. And so there's only so much you can do as a pitcher. I played every day on the road except for the day I pitched. Maddux played every day except for the day before he pitched. And Glavine and myself and basically our starting five, we always had a standing foursome on the one day that somebody would pitch. So I was the golf coordinator, the concierge, got the rent a car, got the setup, and it extended our careers. We talk about it all the time. It gave us something to get away from the obsession of our sport and trying to become as good as we can become. Baseball is a long and kind of torturous season, even though it may not be as demanding as football. I would argue it's the hardest season to play in any sport because you don't have that many off days and you're constantly going at it. Not to mention spring training being about 45 days long too. So it definitely, we needed something good to get our mind away from what we do every single time we get to the park.
We are so pleased to be joined by the National Baseball Hall of Famer, John Smoltz, who has been the lead game analyst for Fox Sports coverage of their marquee events since, 2015, 2016?
2016, yeah, I think it's going to be my 11th season. 2016 was when the Cubs came back and beat Cleveland. That was my first World Series, if I've got my years right. They were down 3-1, and I got a chance to call that with Joe Buck.
What was that transition like for you to go from full-time player to now being the announcer on a national basis?
Well, it's definitely different because the game has changed dramatically, and you can't stay in neutral. You got to be able to adapt to the game that's being played today. I would say from a standpoint, it's nowhere close to the way it was played when I was playing, but that's just the nature of sports and analytics, everything that's been infused in the game. And it's a little bit slower in the booth. You can see things and draw from your experience. The one thing that I always prided myself on, if I ever got into this business, is never approach it like it's easy, right? The game, sometimes you get certain broadcasters that come across like the game was much easier when they played. And it's not the case. The game's hard. Your job as a broadcaster is explain to the person at home why they think they can do what we're doing that they can't. And that a mistake made at the big league level, although be it might look obviously bad, it's not, unless they do it over and over again, this is a tough game. And you have to explain why those mistakes are made, why pressure is infused in the game, why guys would throw a pitch or swing at a pitch or make a play. So that's been my biggest, when I sit in the booth, I just remind myself the game wasn't easy when I played. It's not easy now. And the fan that is sitting there watching something, hopefully they get an intel or an inside that they could never get, or something they could never look up based on how I explain the game.
John, I've always been interested in the production meetings that NFL announcers have when they go in for a Sunday game, and they'll meet, they'll fly in on Friday. They'll meet with the coaches and a player or two on a Saturday. That's just for one game a week, particularly when it comes to a playoff series. When you and Joe Davis go in and prep for, you know, a five-game series or a seven-game series that lasts obviously multiple days and in different ballparks, how do you prep and meet with the, you know, the managers and the players in advance and then during playing of the series?
Yeah, so I'm a little bit different. I don't meet with players mainly because I know they got a lot of things going on and I know what they're going to tell me. Because if I were a player and got asked, I would know what I was going to say. That doesn't mean that that's the right way. We meet with the managers. The way I approach it, let's say a regular season game, it's hard to make a you can't make a regular season game a playoff game, right? It doesn't matter how big of the matchup is. It might take me 3 to 5 hours on a game day. I've got it down to about 3 hours for a regular season game. Come postseason, it might be all day. Just looking at matchups, looking at trends, looking at how I would pitch that team, and then try to come up with a strategy and a plan based on the accumulation of stats. Stats are great to give a bigger overall picture, but it doesn't tell the in-game matchup. And so I'll look at a lot more video of pitching and hitting than I will in a regular season game. And then once you get in the postseason, you're creating this following of this team, and it gets easier as the games go on. But there is a lot of time to dive into the further you go in the postseason. So we start with a team, and we will end with that team that keeps winning all the way through the World Series. So then the only challenge becomes whoever in the other league comes to play in the World Series, you got to catch up with them.
John, you started Game 7 in 91 in that famous game with the Twins, unfortunately for your Braves, ultimately winning 1-0 in 10 innings. I'm wondering how you compare that game, that series, to the series last year with the Dodgers and the Blue Jays, with the Dodgers in almost improbable fashion, John, winning in Game 7 over the Blue Jays. How do you compare those two? And was last year, John Smoltz, was that the best World Series you've ever seen?
I think you can make the argument from 1 to 7, it was one of the best World Series I've ever seen. We had a lot of incredible games in our Minnesota, Atlanta. I don't think anybody really puts a lot of credit going into that World Series. They thought it was going to be a dud, two last place teams, and then all of a sudden we had a lot of epic games, including Game 6 and Game 7. But your point's well taken. Because of the way the Dodgers were built and the way that Toronto was playing, this was a perfect example of how sometimes, they talk about experience matters. Well, it only matters when you put yourself in position to execute. And the Dodgers use that experience, and it's the reason they won. I mean, if they play that game in those same situations from Game 6 to Game 7 10 more times, there's no doubt Toronto wins 9 of them. But it only takes that one time, and you execute split second, you make the right decisions, the right plays, the right pitches. And I'm not saying that Toronto got tight, but their lack of experience might have cost them in some split second moves that the day before in Game 6, they got doubled off to end the game. If you remember in Game 7, they got very conservative with their leads and they got thrown out at home plate by a fraction of a foot or an inch. And that lack of lead and that conservative approach unfortunately cost them a World Series. But I say all that because in the moment when things are happening fast, the team that could slow it down and do the things they have to do, which the Dodgers did, that's why you have to give them credit. Forget about their payroll. Forget about their roster. It was about experience. And the Toronto Blue Jays put up, and the Dodgers put up, one of the most epic World Series that we're going to see in a long time.
Talked about slowing things down, and I mentioned that Game 7 in 91. Was that, I mean, you went, what, 8 shutout innings, I believe, John?
Yeah.
Was that a matter of did you just kind of slow it down somehow in the greatest pressure cooker you can have as a major league player?
You know, I'm not saying everybody's wired like this, but I had a belief when I was young that I wanted the ball in every big situation that I would deliver. I relished and welcomed the pressure. I wish more postseason games were played in less regular season games. There's something about my brain type that loves the moment. It doesn't guarantee the moment, but if you're not in a position and you're not afraid to fail and you don't want the moment, you have no chance of being successful. And so all the way back to that season in 1991, I started out 2-11. It didn't start well. It ended fantastically, and I proved that I could overcome some of those things that were troubling me in the regular season in the first half. I pitched 9 innings in Saturday game to get us into the postseason. That's the one that Greg Olson jumped in my arm. It wasn't one of my greatest games. I think I'd given up 4 or 5 runs, but went 9 innings. Different era, different time frame. I was able to pitch game 7 in the pennant to get us to the World Series. 9 innings, no runs, and Greg Olson jumps in my arms again. When I got to game 7, it was the ultimate dream. I was pitching on 3 days rest. So to me, that was where I wanted to be. I dreamt that as a kid. I pitched every game in my mind like that. I felt like I could have kept going. I didn't have enough years to tell my manager to you get off the mound. It ended up the way it ended up. It was a tough loss, but it was everything that I had hoped for. And to be in that situation, the game was slow. The roar was dull. I like to think, I tell people all the time, the loudest places I've ever been as a broadcaster has been obviously in some rabid, like, cities that just couldn't wait for the first time. Seattle was so loud. Philadelphia was so loud. Toronto, because of a dome, was so loud. If you're on the other side of that and it's loud to you as a player, you're in trouble. If it's a dull roar, you're focused and you're keeping things under control, because the only way it gets loud is runners on base or runs. It doesn't just stay loud if no runner gets on and there's no rallies and you're doing your job as a pitcher, or vice versa if you're a hitter and you hit a home run on the road. So keeping it simple and quiet and slow, you hear that all the time. That's an innate ability that players learn to do either over time or it's been part of their DNA. And you can make that argument for some of the greatest in the world. So come postseason time, I loved it. That's where I thrived. That's where my weapons came out. And I pitched in, I think, 40 some games. I don't know how many as a starter, but I would have wished it could have doubled.
Was it harder to be Was it harder to be a starter, or ultimately when you transitioned to be a reliever?
Way harder as a reliever. My personality fits for being a starter. Everything's structured. I love the uniformity of it. That 1 every 5 days as a closer, you go by the seat of your pants. You got to wait to do your job, and if game doesn't go well, you're frustrated. I had to learn all that. And starting to me is something I can control from start to finish. Closing is only something I can do if everyone else does their job. So I learned how to do it. I wouldn't say it was my sweet spot, but it was the hardest thing I've ever had to do.
We're going to close with golf questions in just a second, but let me give you 3 rapid fire baseball questions, John, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay. Greatest pitchers of your era, of your generation, not named Smoltz, Glavin, or Maddox. Give me one pitcher, in your opinion, who was the best among those you played against.
Man. Many come up. Randy Johnson, Pedro Martinez, who I ironically went into the Hall of Fame with, were from each side, 2 of the nastiest guys I've ever seen. So I'm going to go with them.
In your opinion, greatest pitcher of all time, and why?
Greatest pitcher of all time. Of all time is a little unfair, because I wish I could have seen Warren Spahn a little bit more. I wish I could have seen Sandy Koufax a little bit more. Sandy Koufax, based on his tenure and based on the fact that he didn't play as long and didn't develop, but you never know what would have happened. I mean, it's hard to go away from Sandy Koufax from his era, but I would say that, you know, that question there, that is filled with really no wrong answer.
Right among the current crop today, who's the best pitcher today, in your opinion?
You go back and forth right now between Tarek Skubal and Paul Skenes. The most complete evolutionary watch from the beginning to the end. Unfortunately, his injury may take the rest of his career. I hope not. Zach Wheeler is one of those under the radar, what they look like type pitchers. I've been enamored with him because he started with the Mets, he had the Tommy John, and he got to the elite level with the Philadelphia Phillies, and unfortunately he's had that shoulder surgery. But that, to me, is what pitching's all about. The guys, the way they look like today, yeah, they do it probably more dominant than anybody has ever seen, but I don't think they're going to last. I hope they do, but based on the evidence that we're seeing, nobody lasts without getting a Tommy John because of the effort and the max effort that they throw a baseball. Not one person in this generation has survived it yet. I hope the two guys I mentioned survive it and find a way to have a long career, because that's what we all got to enjoy. And that's the one missing component in our sport today.
Hope this is not a naive question, but is that what you just said, is that bad for baseball, or is that just the fact of where baseball is today?
I think it's horrible for baseball. I think football figured it out, and they ended up with a rule change to keep their quarterbacks upright. Nobody liked it in the beginning, but their product would absolutely suffer if every quarterback was starting to get injured and star quarterbacks were no longer part of the mix. We're losing the star factor in our starting rotation, and the way baseball operates, they just see them as a replaceable commodity that they're going to be more coming because that's what everyone's training to do. Guys are chasing the reward system. I think it's a horrible reward system, but if it financially works in the eyes of analytics and Major League Baseball, and there's no rule change coming, which I believe there will be, then they're going to keep operating this way. I've been saying this for 15 years, and people think, well, he must hate baseball. No, I hate the fact that guys are getting hurt and don't have a chance to play 10 to 20 years, which we had a chance to do. We chased our reward system. We got rewarded. They're chasing their reward system. They're getting rewarded with a big, big bank account, but a lot less years on the mound or on the field.
Final few questions as we're winding down our time with John Smoltz here on Musings on Golf. Hey, John, I'm wondering, you advanced to the final stage of qualifying for PGA Tour Champions. I'm wondering, what was the difference for you in getting to that point, but not being able to get over the hump and actually qualify for the 15 over group?
Well, it may be the hardest qualifying situation in all of sports, because of the way they've each their own, that they've made it that way, and they don't want anybody getting through the grid that hasn't really deserved to be through it. I make a lot of mistakes in golf. I had planned to do about two tournaments within that stretch of qualifying. I literally, when I got to Arizona, had played 30 out of 32 days of golf. Big mistake. Should have canceled the tournament before then once I found out I qualified. But what I found interesting is, at no point in Bermuda Greens in Florida had I had over 28 putts in any round. Finished under par in four rounds. At no point in any round did I have under 36 putts in Arizona. The surface difference and the lack of speed and the loss of speed that I had in my putter was nauseating. So I had virtually no chance after the first round, but I learned the differences of preparation and time that you need to do for this. And look, it's a challenge for me. It was something I wanted to do because it was another excuse to play golf. It was not something I was going to do full time. I enjoyed my time on the Champions Tour. They gave me all kinds of opportunities. About 3 years ago, got both hips, my hips replaced. I decided I would never do anything unless I qualified again. And now we've started a new tour called the Pro, and I'm the commissioner of the Pro, and it gives me
a little bit about that, John, please.
Yeah, well, we have an opportunity here of really threading the needle in something unbelievable, and we have all our sports retired players. So our tour, the Pro, is where you go when you retire, and your competition is gone. Now all these guys are competing. We're competing for a tour championship. We have eight tournaments. We've already done one. We got another one coming up. We've got some dynamic young studs that have retired early and some old farts like me, and maybe even a little older in the 60s. But we compete amongst all crosses of sports. The primary focus is the four major sports, of course, baseball, basketball, football, and hockey. And then we have all the other sports that just don't have the depth right now. About 125 players vying for 80 spots. And we'll have a point system and a unique championship that we think is going to be unlike any of. On the tour championship standpoint, we get to the final 30 players. The top four in each sport are represented in each sport, so that's 16. Then the next 14 top point getters will comprise of our 30. The final 30 will have two rounds of Stableford, which will then get to the top one in each sport. And the next four places, highest places, will make an eight-man match play championship. So we go from stroke play or Stableford to an eliminator. So it's a race to the chase for the eight-man playoff in the match play. And then at that point, anybody can beat anybody, and it's 1 versus 8, 2 versus 7. And we just think that one of the things that we're going to be able to offer is we're a professional trash talking tour. If you think about it, we love what we're doing because it's not our current sport that we were either burned out or had an expiration date. And we're going to come together and create a VIP experience for those who get a chance to look at those they either disliked or liked rooting for in all kinds of sports. Guys love it. And we just think that, you know, this thing's going to explode. And I have to learn how to be the quote unquote commissioner and play, because the dual responsibilities in my first tournament definitely are a lot.
Based on everything you've just outlined, Commissioner, you seem to have, you've got a terrific plan in place. When's the first event of 2026, John?
We had it already in Orlando at the Evermore, at an epic two-hole playoff between baseball as the deepest field, okay? And I've let everybody know that. But then you've got the guys like Marty Fish and Joe Pavelski, and there's so many. Ray Allen in basketball, Tony Romo in football. There's so many good players. So our second event's coming up at Indian Wells here February 16th. That'll be our second event. Then we have one each month leading into our playoffs, which the first playoff is the top 40 in August, which will be at Turning Stone in New York. And then our championship will be at Black Desert in Utah on September, in the September month. So we do midweek. We don't do weekends. We start a pro-am on Monday and run our tournament Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And we're slow walking this thing the first year, and then it is going to explode.
Don, is there a website for the pro?
Yeah. Protour.com, the pro, is definitely, and we're in the tweaking form. I think it might be pro tour, but protour.com is definitely going to, the protour.com. You'll see, what we're doing and what we're building. And we've got an amazing opportunity with content that we're going to be providing in the future. You know how all this world works and the content viewing and everything. So we create an environment that's similar to what we were used to in a locker room type hang. We go up and we set up a course and we take over a ballroom and put up 80 lockers. We've got a lounge room for guys to hang out, massage chairs, recovery room. We're basically thinking of all the things that would entice the players that this is fresh for us. See, golf is fresh.
Yes.
Whereas imagine if you had to do this in baseball and you had to do like a pro-am while you're pitching, you know, and trying to, I understand how difficult it is to do it as your livelihood. And we're not trying to compete with anybody. And we're certainly not trying to do anything other than we miss competition. And this is a great way. Golf is a unifier. We've seen what it's done since COVID. It's exploded. And golf is one of those things that doesn't have an expiration date similar to what our sports do.
Don Smoltz, two final questions. One, at the outset, we talked about the American Century and your desire to get that victory. What's the area or areas that you need to improve on to finally raise that trophy in Tahoe?
Consistency in my short game, putting, the 8-footer. I practice a lot of long putts. I don't 3-putt a ton, but it's the consistency of making that 5 to 8 footer. And I know what the stats say. It's less, 8-footer in the PGA Tour is like 55% make. It's not even that what people thought, you know. So I think I change putters a little bit too much. I change my eyesight and definitely things that I'm looking to do. I would rather play than practice. So I need to practice more than I play. It's a hard thing for me. I love playing. I love that every day golf has an opportunity for that might be the day. That's the day you shoot your career round. It's hard to back that up, but I need to be a little bit more fearless. Like you asked the question, I got to be a little more fearless in the first round and be a little more aggressive, not out of control, and then let that aggression work in my favor.
John Smoltz, final question. It's one I've asked all of our guests, and the responses have been most interesting. That it's a simple one. Who would round out for you a dream foursome, whether those individuals are still with us or they're deceased? Who would those three be, and where would you play that magical, very cool round of golf?
Yeah, that's always the greatest question anyone's ever asked me. I like golf to be, somebody's got to be funny. I got to play golf, and somebody funny could be any top comedian or anybody who just generally would make you laugh, right? So let's just say, you know, Bill Murray's in the group, and he's definitely going to make the round enjoyable. I'd want somebody that I could walk down the fairway with and pick their brain, because I've never know what they have been through or how they got through it. And let's just say a Jackie Robinson would be my second pick, because I could have time to really pick his brain or find out, you know, how it was doing what he did in my sport and breaking that color barrier. And then, of course, you know, Tiger's always going to be in the group, in the mix. But then I want to go, I have never played with Jack Nicklaus. You know, I've gotten a chance to play with Arnold Palmer and got a chance to play with Chichi Rodriguez, Lee Trevino, all the greats in the different eras. That to me would be pretty cool, to have a foursome of two of the greatest all time. One I get to learn from and pick his brain. The other one, I was just a moment away from laughing.
Where would you guys get together and play?
At that point, it wouldn't matter, but I would say, you know, if we were playing, I've always been an Oakmont fan. I mean, obviously my backyard's Augusta. You can't go wrong with either of those. You can't go wrong with the views of whether it's Cypress or Pebble Beach. I would probably pick a course that I'd pick Oakmont. I don't even know why, but that's where I'm going to go. I'm going to pick Oakmont.
By the way, isn't that also one of the great things about golf is the venues, John, that you get to see, experience so much, so many different locations, you know, whether it's domestically, worldwide. Oakmont is very different than Cypress Point, is very different than Augusta National, right?
It is. My question that I get asked about golf, where would I want to play? I'm very spoiled when it comes to all year round condition. You give me a golf course that could be ready for a major in a week, which Oakmont always claims, and I believe. I've never played Oakmont where it hasn't been in great, great condition. Now, that doesn't say it's like that 100% of the time, but it's like that more than it's not. And I'm very, I guess I said I would never get to that spoiled elite level in golf where I get mad when I only hit it to 10 feet and should be 6, but I do like great condition golf courses. And that's kind of where I rank my courses.
John Smoltz, this has been a delight. Wishing you all the best, Commissioner, with the pro, and certainly as the individual going into the American Century Celebrity Golf Championship 2026. John Smoltz, get it done, please.
I have that marked on my number one list. Thank you.
At William & Harry Golf, comfort meets purpose. Through their care campaign, William & Harry is partnering with charities to give back, donating a portion of every qualifying sale to support your cause. Enhance your next fundraiser with William & Harry customized golf shoes, auction packages, or exclusive giveaways. Crafted from fine deerskin, calfskin, and exotic leathers, William & Harry golf shoes offer all-day comfort from the course to the clubhouse in vibrant, eye-catching colors. Learn more at williamandharry.com or email info@williamandharry.com. William & Harry, style with a mission. Golf is more than your scorecard, the brand of clubs you play, or the clothes you wear. Golf is a journey where every round is a memory, filled with friends old and new. The Friars Golf Club is where those lifelong friendships are made, on the first tee, in the 19th hole, and far beyond. Exclusive trips, unforgettable rounds, and the very best people. Indeed, great courses are simply better with great company. So join the Friars today. To learn more, email us at info@thefriars.com and put the word musings in the subject line to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. So we invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience at the Friars Golf Club. John Smoltz, thank you so much for being part of Musings on Golf this week. I hope everybody enjoyed that fabulous interview, and wishing John all the best with the pro, his new involvement with the series of events with the big four major sports, those guys who have retired. And John, as he noted in there, is the commissioner of that new tour, that new playing series. And most importantly, John, best of luck. Get that win at the American Century Celebrity Golf Championship. Let's cover a few things here. I want to start with somebody who did not win at the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am, and that's Scottie Scheffler. Put this for a statistic. In his three PGA Tour events this year, the American Express, the WM Phoenix Open, and the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am, Scottie Scheffler is 62 under par. He won the American Express. He tied for third at WM Phoenix. He was tied for fourth at AT&T. He now has 18 straight top 10 finishes. He just has not started. He started slowly the last 2 weeks, and yet somehow has clawed his way back by making a bunch of birdies. I mean, at Phoenix, for example, he opened with 73, and he closed with 64, finished at 15 under. And then at Pebble Beach, what a run. He opened with even par 72, closed with 63 to finish, as I said, tied for fourth. Scottie Scheffler could just get out to a good start this week at Genesis. It's hard to imagine that anyone other than Scottie Scheffler will win at Riviera. What drama there at the end of the Pebble Beach National Pro-Am, the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. You know, just imagine putting yourself in a position where you have to wait on a shot to maybe win your club championship, or to, you know, to win a state amateur event. And for whatever reason, the guy in front of you is going through rulings and keeping you in a spot where your mind is wandering and could go any number of places. Well, certainly Jacob Bridgman didn't do anything intentionally, but everything that happened with him hitting his second shot down on the rocks to the left of the 18th green at Pebble Beach and getting rulings, and ultimately somehow he made a bogey out of it, but it took 20 minutes. And Colin Morikawa, who knew he needed to make birdie at 18 to win the tournament, is back there with one of the toughest second shots you could find in golf. And man, credit to Morikawa. All credit to him. It's been a long trip for him. I mean, a long time, really. As I mentioned before the interview with John Smoltz, that this is his first time he's won in 5 years on the PGA Tour. The Zozo Championship, played in Japan in October of 23, was the last time he had won on the PGA Tour at all. This was his seventh victory. And talking about being able to step up and hit that second shot that he did at 18, knocked it up there near the green, got it up and down for the victory. And golf is better in a lot of ways, I think, with Colin Morikawa winning on the PGA Tour. He's won two major championships, very likable guy. And as you'll hear from this clip, Morikawa acknowledges that he kind of got a little technical, which can happen in golf, right? And he got back working with PGA professional Rick Sessinghouse, who really helped Colin, become the player that he did, and helped him kind of free up his mind, and helped him and encouraged him to what? Just go out and play the game. So just like that second shot he had to hit at 18, just go ahead and hit that second shot. Don't worry about the picture where you want the ball to go. Don't worry so much about the mechanics. And what happened? As I said, he knocked it up there, made birdie, gets the win. Let's hear what Colin Morikawa had to say about what he refers to as the art of golf, as opposed to the mechanical side that had kind of bogged him down.
Yeah, there's an art to golf. And I think with the more and more technology, it's great that, you know, to advance and figure out what you need to do better and how to perfect certain things, how to hit great shots. But there's an art, and we're artists at heart. And like I said, like, I've gone away from that a little bit. I mean, for me, like being able to picture those shots and seeing those, you know, the curvature, how the wind's going to affect it. I mean, today the best shot I think I hit was probably on, well, 18 was great, but on 7, you know, I've stood on that tee where it's been really windy. And you start thinking about numbers, you start thinking about, man, is a 9-iron enough, 8-iron, is a wedge. And I just took out 9-iron, I looked at Mark, we kind of nodded heads, and like, it's all feel. And that's that artistry, I think, that a lot of people, you know, lose maybe over time. You definitely have that as a kid, and it's how do you get that back? And this week was really, really big for pulling that out.
Well, I think there's a lesson to be learned there. Golf... And I, you know, we had Dr. Bob Rotella on last year, and no one knows that better and has been able to communicate that better to PGA Tour players than Dr. Rotella. It somehow you have to play the game. Yes, the mechanics are important, but if they override the joy you have for the game, just going out and kind of playing like when you were a kid, you'll only go so far at that level. A guy who has played extremely well, but we haven't seen in a long time, also is kind of back in the news in a way, and that's Tiger Woods. What a fascinating press conference Tiger had on Tuesday, February 17th. We're recording this the morning of Wednesday, February 18th, so we were able to include Tiger's comments. In the same press conference, Tiger Woods talked about possibly playing, and now that he's turned 50, on the PGA Tour Champions, playing in a golf cart. At the same time, he wouldn't rule out playing in the Masters this year in just, what, 6 weeks? I don't think that's likely, but he sort of keeps his name in the, if he just says, well, I'm not going to play, then that sort of takes the, you know, some of the mystery away from it. He's talking about playing, hitting full shots. Oh, that's fine and dandy. Fact of the matter is, Tiger hasn't played in any competitive golf since the 2024 Open Championship. And I think he'll probably take it down to the wire and then say, you know, I'm just not ready. Even though he obviously knows Augusta National extremely well. I don't think it would be a wise thing for him to try, because I don't think he would play particularly well. He also was non-committal to being the Ryder Cup captain. The PGA of America clearly has reached out to him. He's got a lot going on with his involvement with the future competition committee on the PGA Tour board, and that's taking up a lot of his time. I think he's trying to figure out where a Ryder Cup captaincy for Adele Manor in Ireland in 2027 would fit in. But let's hear what Tiger had to say about, there's been so much discussion about what is the future of the PGA Tour going to look like. And I thought his answers were as revealing as they possibly could be when he spoke to the media at Riviera.
What do you see as the biggest challenge in trying to put this new schedule together?
Well, I think it's trying to serve literally everyone, from the player side of it, from our media partners, from all of our title sponsors, from the local communities, or even changing venues and going to bigger markets. It's what do we need to do from a competitive model to make our tour the best product it can possibly be each and every year and still have room for development? How do we do all of that at the same time? And so that's been the challenging part, because there's been a lot of moving parts over the last couple of years to try and get us into the position that we're in now with the FCC, or it's the boards being unified and linked together and working together. So it's been a lot of moving parts, but it's been in sync that we've had a lot of information thrown our way, which has been great. And everyone's working collaboratively together. And that's where I was hesitant that we're going to be in this position where we're going to work together like this and function at a level and to make our product better. But everyone is. Everyone's trying to make the PGA Tour the best tour in the world, make it better than what it is now, trying to give those opportunities to players and the next generations to come.
Do you anticipate this new schedule happening in 2027?
We would like to have it happen in 2027. We may have to roll it out over a couple year period. We may not be able to be implemented all of it in 2027, but there will definitely be parts of it integrated or changed then from what it is now in 26 into 27.
All right, final thing with you in regards to your recovery, is the Masters off the table for you?
No.
Well, there's a lot going on in the game of golf. And as I mentioned, the PGA Tour finishes up the West Coast Swing this week at Riviera Country Club outside of Los Angeles. And then they head my way, where I'm in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, for the Cognizant Classic here at PGA National Resort and Spa next week. It should be a terrific, terrific event at Riviera. Again, if Scottie Scheffler, if he shoots something in the 60s on Thursday, he'll win the tournament. For Jenna Self, Kelly Elbin, thanking you so much for listening, being part of Musings on Golf once again. Look forward to talking to you next week.